Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the first of a two-part conversation between former professor of economics at UCLA, Armin Alchin, and famous economist Friedrich von Hayek. Originally recorded in 1978, this conversation provides a uniquely personal and entertaining look on Hayek's life and work as they dive into past events and relationships Hayek formed along the way. We hope you enjoyed today's episode and stop back next week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Some of your early students, and you mentioned Mrs. Lutz, Vera Lutz. Where did you first have her as a student? Was this in Vienna?
At the London School of Economics. London.
Was she married then to...
No.
Did you arrange that?
Almost. Right. I sent her to study in Freiburg. And Lutz was still in Freiburg. And she came back bringing Lutz to London. And after a while, they married.
This was a Swiss Freiburg?
Freiburg where I am now, Freiburg in Breisgau. Lutz himself was a pupil of Eucken in Freiburg. And at that time, which was already after the Nazi, Freiburg was the only German university which still had a fairly independent and active intellectual life. So when for her purpose she was doing the thesis on the development of central banking and particularly the free banking discussion in the middle of the 19th century, so I sent her to Freiburg to become familiar with the German literature, and there she met Lutz and induced Lutz to come to London in turn, and ultimately they married.
My recollection is that they were an attractive couple when I got to know them, which was maybe about 10 years ago, but I suspect that when she was young, she might have been a pretty good-looking woman.
Very good-looking woman, and extremely intelligent, but she wasn't really very female. He had too much of a male intelligence.
Well, our chauvinism comes out. Let's go to a male student. You mentioned earlier about Skatovsky. Did he just show up in one of your classes?
In that case, his father brought him to me from Budapest.
When you were in Vienna with this?
No, I was already in London. He brought him to London and wanted somebody who's familiar with Central European conditions, so he came to me and brought a young boy. Mm-hmm. Will you look after him a little while he's a student, the first time in a foreign country? And then we got on very well together. I believe he did his thesis under Robbins, but when you ask about my pupils during this English period, in most instances I won't know whether it was really formally Robbins or mine. We had a common seminar, and it was pure chance which of us undertook to supervise the thesis. So in most instances I wouldn't know was he formally Robbins or my pupil. It was really joint seminar and joint arrangements.
How did you run the joint seminar? Where did you assign topics to students, or did you and Robbins pick a topic and discuss it?
There was always a main topic for the whole year, which I think without injustice I can say Robbins did all the organizing work, including choosing the general topic. But once it came to discussion, I more or less dominated the discussion.
Well, did the two of you dominate the discussion, or were the students doing most of the discussing?
Very much. Listening? You see, we had gradually developed a sort of front. It was a large seminar. I suppose 30 or 40 people attended.
Oh, I see.
But there was always a front row of people who had been members of seminar for 2 or 3 years already, and they dominated the discussion, and included not only students, but people like John Hicks, who was a regular member of the seminar, Freddie Benham, who was a regular member of the seminar. After a while, of course, Kaldor had emerged from the upper learner.
He took over.
Oh, I see. So after a while, I would say almost at front row were assistants and junior lecturers at LSE.
Do you recall any of the seminar's topics or main themes?
I think it began and dominated.
This was 1931?
31 or 32. I started teaching in London in the autumn of 31. I suppose it was in that year that we started on the theory of production. And it turned all on a paper model of the production function, which somebody had made. and Allen and Hicks were evolving their own theories.
Both this is R.G.D. Allen?
R.G.D. Yeah. Allen and John Hicks were developing their own theories. Well, I don't think whether I ought to mention it, I doubt whether John Hicks remembers it, but it's almost a joke of history that I had to draw Hicks' attention, who came from Marshall to indifference curves.
Well, that was a good, well-planted seed.
And in that sense,
Now, how did you happen to know about indifference curves?
Well, I had, of course, spent all my early years on utility analysis and all its forms. And we had in Vienna, Rosenstein Rodan, who wrote that great article on Marshall utility, and with him, we waded through the whole literature on the subject of Marshall utility, including, and I was very attracted in a way by the indifference curve analysis. Mm-hmm. I thought it was the most satisfactory form, particularly because when it became clear that it unified the theory of production, the theory of utility, mm-hmm. with a similar apparatus. Mm-hmm. So by the time I came to London, although I've never been thinking of it in algebraic terms, the geometry of it was very familiar to me.
So, that's an aspect of background about Hicks that I wasn't aware of. I wondered how come he suddenly got into that. Well, I want to go back, though, to that seminar. Since I do some teaching, I'd like to know what other...
International trade was 1 year, the main subject.
So. And again, it was you and Robbins who...
From 31 till 40, till Robbins went into government service at the beginning of the war, every year we had this common seminar, which was the center of the graduate school in economics. And people who were sitting in were not only those young junior teachers at LSE and assistants who gradually became teachers, but people like Arnold Plant, who regularly sat in with us without taking an active part, but was extremely helpful to great practical knowledge. Occasionally, but only the first few years, T. Gregory would still come in, who was a senior of the department. But he was already somewhat remote. I think it is true to say that although formally, so the early part of the period, Robbins, I, and Gregory, senior, were the three professors of economics, with Plant as professor of commerce joining in. Gregory was gradually getting interested outside the School of Economics, so his influence was comparatively small. I don't know where I may be forgetting. Barrett Whale also.
Oh, Barrett Whale, yes. Those are all familiar. I started my studies of economics in 1933 and 34, and those names were well known then. Where did these meetings occur? Where were these meetings? Where was the seminar?
The seminar room, which was then behind the refectory of the London School of Economics, where we had a sort of small hand library on the side, things we most frequently used, and usually held in the afternoon.
If I were to go there now, could you tell me how to get there?
No, you wouldn't find the same room that in the course of the reconstruction has disappeared.
Oh, I see, too bad. That's what I was going to ask you.
That room no longer exists.
Now, were the topics for each week assigned, or did somebody have a paper?
Oh, there were papers, but the discussion of any paper might go on for several weeks.
Independently of the paper itself, sometimes. Who were the people, although you said that you maybe dominated the discussion after Robin started, were there some of the people there who were very forceful personalities?
Abba Lerner.
I see.
Very important.
By virtue of intellectual power rather than by...
Among those people who started as students and continued as assistants and senior lecturers, Kaldor, Abba Lerner, because for a time even Hicks took position almost as a junior lecturer and then rose gradually to a dominating personality. There were two or three others whom I've lost sight of. Well, there was the unfortunate Victor Edelberg, with the name.
I know of him. I don't know why it's unfortunate that he died earlier.
Well, I think he is finally in an lunatic institution. Oh, right. He completely went to pieces. Mm-hmm. And a man called Araki, whom I've completely, not a Japanese, Araki is also a Japanese name. Adler, who I believe is now with the International Bank or somewhere. But as I say, there were a group of six or eight very senior students, or ultimately graduate assistants, who throughout the years, and of course there was a constant flow of American visitors. Yeah. I think every year we had one or two junior American lecturers or even junior professors were passing through and spending a year with us. Mm-hmm. Including, who was the former president of Berkeley, who has recently...
Clark Kerr?
Not Kerr, no.
Hitch?
Huh?
Hitch?
Yes.
Charlie Hitch?
It's Hitch.
Yeah, he was an Oxford scholar, I guess.
He was one of them. Mm-hmm. In the end, but that's only a post-war thing, Arthur Lewis, who played a similar role in the seminar later.
Did Abba Lerner still wear, or not still, was he then not wearing neckties and open-toed shoe and wearing open sandals?
Yes. Oh, he was a very recent convert to civilization.
He told me that when he was a very young child, they were so poor, his mother used to put water in the milk. And he always thereafter liked skim milk.
Yes. He was then a Trotskyist. Mm-hmm. Who had, before he came to the university, I believe failed in business, become interested in economics because he had failed in business, was from the beginning extremely good.
So you said he failed in what?
In business. He had been a practical business, sort of small shop or something.
I
never found out quite what it was.
Smuggling books, maybe.
And, you know, in the end, well, that, I think, ought to be under lock and key for the next 25 years.
You can remember to put it on the audio tape if you wish, or else tell us. Although he would probably tell it himself if he were here. I don't want to press on a matter which should be under lock and key, but I hope you'll remember to put it under lock and key.
No, I don't think, if you don't exactly... make it public now. I was going to say simply this, that in the end we had the problem. We could, both Calder and Lerner were clearly such exotic figures that we couldn't keep them both in the department. And one of very few points on which Robinson and I ever disagreed was which of the two to retain.
I'd heard that there was a dispute, and my impression or recollection, you needn't correct it or say it was right or wrong, was that you favored Lerner and he favored Calder. They all make mistakes.
I don't think it was a mistake.
I think you were right. Yeah.
It would have been done a great deal of good to England if Lerner had stayed and Calder had gone to America.
Oh, I don't wish that on his life. Lerner's a kind of very good friend of mine. In fact, his book, Economics of Control, was the first book I read after the war, about 1945, when I was in Texas then in the Air Force, and I had a chance to go to a library. I pulled off the shelf Lerner's Economics of Control, saw this book by how it got there. I don't know. It was in Fort Worth, Texas. And I also pulled off the shelf later an article by the economist at Princeton who was writing an attack on marginalism. I forgot who it was. It's just the one I've forgotten his name because it was a terrible article. And I read it and I was so distressed. I said, what's happening economics in the years I've been away? And then I read Lerner's book. And it was a very influential book.
Oh, very understanding. Very, I still think it's a very good book.
It is
mistaken on some points. But
yes, it's very good.
Oh, another person who was for a time member of seminar, it's obvious why I remember it after Lerner, was Oscar Lange.
Yes, he was one of my teachers, but he was here at Stanford and came every afternoon, once a week, and gave a course in mathematical economics, which we learned the standard mathematics, but no economics as such. We just learned how to formulate the models. And then we would walk from the campus to the railroad, to the what was then the railway station. Right. And he'd tell me some things about his, about socialism, why socialism is a good thing. And somehow it never quite took, fortunately, I guess I should say. In those seminars, did you go to a blackboard very much? And are you a blackboard user?
Not I personally. Mm-hmm. Occasionally for for a diagram. But blackboard was used much. I mean, people like Hicks and Allen.
I was going to, which ones dash the board right away? Somehow I've never seen you at a blackboard. I wondered what you'd be like, whether you use it a lot. I cannot work without a blackboard, just to make marks, if nothing else. Were you always white-haired? Of course not.
But oh, no.
Were you very dark-haired or light or blonde? Or?
It was a darkish brown. And I think I retained it into my late 50s.
I see. And how did you have it? Was it always parted on the side?
Oh, parted, yeah. It was just a little fuller than it is now.
never a severe problem for you. Yeah. You never wore it in wild manners to annoy your parents.
Oh, I did once. You see, I now use as a very effective opening with American students a phrase, 50 years ago, when I first grew a beard in protest against American civilization.
Yeah. Well, there's still some left, I see, a little bit left, so there's a mild protest. But when did you first grow a beard?
On my visit here in 23 and 24.
Oh, you came in 23, 24 then. Let's see, you were then.
I was the first Central European student who came over on his own without a Rockefeller on the basis of a quasi invitation from Jeremiah W. Jenks, if that name still means anything.
J.J.
He was the author of the standard book on trusts. And at New York University, president of Alexander Hamilton Institute. And he came to Vienna in 22 when I met him and explained to him that I was anxious to go to America to improve my knowledge of economics. And he assured me, yes, I'm going to write a book about Central Europe, so if you come over next fall, I can employ you for a time as a research assistant. Now, that was immediately after the end of the inflation in Austria, so to collect enough money even to pay my fare was quite a problem. And I saved even the money on the cable announcing that I would arrive, with the result that when I arrived in New York, I found that Professor Jenks was on holiday and left instructions not to be communicated with. So I had arrived in New York in March 23 with exactly $25 in my pocket. Now, $25 was a lot of money at that time. And I started first presenting all my letters of introduction, which Schumpeter had written for me, each one of which earned me a lunch and nothing else.
Well, that's more than most letters today will earn you. This was in New York, or was this in Boston?
In New York.
New York.
Mm-hmm. And so finally, with the help of another $5, which somebody had slipped in the box of cigarettes he gave me after the luncheon, I lasted for over 2 weeks on that money. And finally was down to, after having reduced my ambitions more and more, to accepting a post as a dishwasher in a Sixth Avenue restaurant. And I was to start next morning at 11 o'clock. It was then a great relief to me and a source of everlasting regret now that I never started washing dishes. But on that morning, a telephone call came. Professor Jenks had to return and was willing to employ me.
Well, I was just about to say we have one thing in common. I also worked as a dishwasher when I first came to Stanford. But you do not have that honor on your record anymore. Well, partly that episode is one that Axel may want to explore more because I'm beginning to get into some of your earlier life and I can see him sitting there saying, let me get at that part of his life.
There's one episode in connection with this. I was then working for Jenks for 6 months in the New York Public Library on the same desk with Macaulay.
Of the bond man,
yes,
of the National Bureau?
Haggard Beckhardt and Willard Thorpe. And Thorpe got me to do the parts on Germany and Austria in his business annals. Mm-hmm. You will find in the preface that, in fact, almost my first publication is a contribution to the business annals.
Was Jenks at NYU at that time, or what? Or
Jenks was at NYU, and that's, yes. I spent much of my time in New York gatecrashing at Columbia without having any formal contact with Columbia. I read the last paper in the last seminar of John Bates Clark.
Oh, you had the honor or the privilege of going to one of his seminars.
He invited me personally. That was one effect of the Schumpeter letters of introduction.
This reminds me that when I was at New York in 1939, I gatecrashed again on the lectures of Hotelling and Abram Wald, to which I've been very, very pleased to think back and having seen them. Let me switch a little bit to some of your works. You, in 1931, you gave the lectures which became Prices and Production.
In January 31, yes.
Why was that the topic you talked about?
I was extremely lucky. In fact, I owe my career very largely to a fortunate accident. I had a year or two, no. Oh, yes, of course, by that time I was invited to speak on the subject. I had more or less already published that book on monetary theorem, the trade cycle. Mm-hmm. And Robbins, who did not know me personally, made this the occasion of asking me to give the lectures. But the form which the lectures took was due to a fortunate accident. I had accepted writing the volume on money for the great German Grundriss der Sozialökonomik, which still hasn't got that volume, because one or two of the people died and I went off to England before completing it. But what I had already done for what was meant to be a great textbook on money was a part of the history of money and monetary theory. So I arrived in London to lecture on monetary theory, better informed about the English monetary discussions of the 19th century than anyone in my audience. Mm-hmm. And the great impression I made was really knowing all about the discussion at the beginning of the 19th century, which even Gregory didn't know as intimately as I did at the time, because nobody knew why I had this special knowledge, but it came extremely useful. And the first lecture of Prices and Production really gives a sketch of the development of these ideas. The ideas itself were also due almost to an accident. When I came back from the United States in 1924, I wrote an article on American monetary policy since the Federal Reserve Act, and had a passage suggesting that an expansionist credit policy leads to an overdevelopment of capital good industries and ultimately to a crisis. And Habler said, I assumed that I was just restating what Mises was teaching. But Habler was as much a pupil as Mises, said, well, that needs explanation, that is not sufficient. So first put in that article a very long footnote, about 25, sketching an outline of what ultimately became my explanation of industrial fluctuations. And then I started writing this out, first in the monetary theory and the trade cycle, and then at this moment, when I was in my ideas, a clear conception of the theory, but hadn't worked it out in detail, I was uniquely, as a face in my, able to give a simple explanation without being aware of all the difficulties of the problem. And this fortunate position, I was asked to give these lectures. Mm-hmm. And so I gave what I still admit is a particularly impressive exposition of an idea, which if I had become aware of all the complications, I couldn't have given. A year later, I probably would have been a highly abstruse argument, which the audience understood. But this particular fortunate juncture of my development, I was able to explain it in a way which impressed people. In spite of the fact that I still had considerable difficulties with English. I mean, I had this year in the United States before, but I never lectured in English. And in fact, I am told, or have been told since, that so long as I stuck to my manuscript, it was partly unintelligible. But the moment I found I could explain freely without following a manuscript, I became intelligible.
I was wanting to ask one line of question, but I'm going to divert for a moment to another line and then come back to this if I don't forget. One of the questions was going to be, do you write your manuscripts, or do you, by longhand, or do you talk them out and have somebody...
I begin with cards, with notes, and so I always carry this sort of thing with me.
That's a little 5x8 card.
And all my ideas first put down this form. Then I still write it out in longhand from these cards the first time, and that is the longest process. Then I still go on myself typing it out in what I suppose is a clean manuscript.
You type it yourself?
Yes. And then starts the problem of correcting, giving it to a typist, correcting it again. So I suppose everything of substance which I've written has been in written out form 3 or 4 times before I sent it.
I want every graduate student to hear that, because you know you got to write, rewrite, and rewrite. And they refuse, they resist strongly the idea that they should rewrite. If they can just get it down in black and white, they think that's it. They just
see, at present moment, I'm very unhappy because this epilogue to the Hope House lecture, I have only finished in May, and it's going finally into print now, with the result that as I was correcting the page proofs, I finally had to insert at the end of the book additions to the text.
That's very important.
Because I always get the best formulations of my ideas after they've already been on the paper.
Yes. Usually when for some people, Machlup for one, when I read his work, I can see the man talking, I can hear him just by the words that come out. And somewhat similarly with you, when I read your work, I can see you standing there talking, because the sentences of the written material are very much like your oral sentences. They're well phrased, well put together. And first time I ever heard you, I remember, I think it was at Princeton in maybe 57 or 55, when was you aware? You got up and gave a spontaneous lecture, and all I could say was, I don't know what you were saying. I said, how can he phrase that so beautifully, so elegantly? Yeah. And you've always done that. That's a remarkable talent that some have. How did you develop it, or was it just natural? Whatever natural may mean.
It's comparatively late, and I learned it, I think, in the process of acquiring English as a lecturing language. I don't think I could have done it in German before. I certainly learned a great deal in acquiring a new language of writing, although I have retained one effect of my German background. My sentences are still much too long.
Yes, I know they are long, but they put together well. Karl Brunner, who's a very good friend of mine, has said the same thing. He said, if you can say it long, you can say it longer in German. All right. Let me go back to the price of the production, because it has a particularly warm place in my heart. The first text, the first book, I'll put this one, my first year in upper division work economics, where we took a technical book that was not a textbook. There were two books. One was Adolf Berle's The Modern Corporation and Private Property in 1934, when I came to Stanford, and your book, Prices and Production. And I tried to go to the library and get that book that I had used, but I couldn't find it. Those two books I've read. And I've reread them. And one, well, they've both been influential. One, I think, is grossly full of error, The Modern Corporation, Private Property. Yours may be grossly full of error. I haven't yet caught them all. But nevertheless, it was a book that set a tone of thinking for me. In the first, I reread it again, knowing I was going to get a chance to talk to you, and I'm not going to ask about the ideas and stuff. There was one point in there I wanted to make to you. In the first lecture, you quote Ricardo, I believe, on Malthus's force saving doctrine. Yeah. And I had not, I don't recall having read that early the first time I read it, but 15, 20 years ago, I did some work on inflation and the force saving doctrine. And I was impressed when I read that particular quote that you had there, because it contains, I think, the correct and the incorrect implications of that doctrine. And then I began to look at the rest of your work to see whether you rested upon the correct or the incorrect doctrine. And fortunately, you rested on the correct doctrine, I think. But I want to explore it again. I won't press you on it, but let me just say that there are two doctrines in there. One is that when you increase the stock of money, as so elegantly said by Ricardo, that the larger stock of money chases the same amount of goods, and someone has to go with less. And the quote does correctly say, those who have money lose value of their money. Then it goes on to make the next statement, which turns out, I will assert here, is incorrect. And that is that business firms make large, unusual profits because of this. And there is the seed of the, instead of simply saying that the wealth transfer from money holders to those who first got the money to spend, it goes on to say there's a transfer of wealth from wage earners to, well, it doesn't say wage earners, but he says there is a gain to the businessman. That is, those who are selling with a price lag. Mm-hmm. And that's an error. It's just the first thing that counts. So in reading your first chapter through, I was paying particular attention to see which of these two you rested your argument on. And fortunately, whether you know it or not, it was not on the second one. It was on the first one.
I don't suppose I saw it as clearly Hamilton as I makes see the thing now. I think it began all with my becoming aware that all assumption that prices are determined by what happened before are wrong. Mm-hmm. That prices, the function of prices, to tell people what they ought to do in future.
Yes. That's the modern rational expectations. Yeah. You can see it in there. As I read it through last week.
Forgive me. The other way around. Mm-hmm. It's by discovering the function of prices as guiding what people ought to do that I finally began to put it in this form.
Yes, yes.
But so many things, I mean, the whole trade cycle theory rested on the idea that prices determine the direction of production. Mm-hmm. You had at the same time the whole discussion of anticipations. Mm-hmm. I found out that the whole Mises argument about calculation ultimately rested on the same idea. And that drove me to the 37 article, which then became the systematic basis of my further development.
No, I was struck by it, and it would be that first essay would be an interesting essay to look at on the history of development of ideas, how the error, the erroneous part of it, was picked up by Keynes. When he talked about excess profits taxes and the wage of lag of wages behind prices, and then picked up by E.J. Hamilton, who had this big explanation of the development of society as a result of the inflation, which hurt the wage earners and transferred wealth to the merchants. That's all fallacious, and the evidence disproves it as well. Mm. But in your part there, not in yours, but in the Ricardo statement, they're both there, and I'd like to see, as I say, repeat myself, you stuck with the right part. Consciously or consciously, I don't care to make any difference. What's also interesting is that I just read a paper, some thoughts by Axel Leeuwenhoek, who was going to be talking to you, and on the Wechselian tradition. And I read it, I was going to say, the last couple of days at the same time. And the similarity between that chapter, your first chapter, and his exposition of Wechsel is quite strong and clear. And again, in reading that paper of Axel's, I can again see how the error that, I call it error, that came in Keynes's work, in the treatise and more the general theory explicitly, where he again, I should say again, where he also abandoned the so-called rational expectations idea of prices depending upon foresight. He slipped into making the error that somehow we expect prices to go down some more tomorrow, so we wait for them until they do go down, a error which today is now becoming
the basis, not the denial, which is the base for the very recent work on rational expectations. But I do remember in my earlier work here at Stanford with Holbert Working, who kept telling me, you know, all prices reflect future anticipations, that when we got to Keynes' book on the general theory, Ed Shaw, who was then here professor at Stanford, gave a course in which I and two others took the course from him, and he just tore that general theory apart for the errors it made in economics, one of which was this one about expectations. Well, that's a long digression, but I'm going to go back and say that in that first chapter there are these two points, and I'm just curious to know whether or not you look back yourself at what you'd written to see if you were consciously aware of having gone down the right path rather than the other path, which led to the kind of error that was in the general theory.
You know, I'm almost inclined to give the famous answer which Pigou once gave to an inquiring American professor. I'm not in the habit of reading my own books.
Yeah, it's a very good trait, I think, yes. But it's a good episode. I put this in here not so much to tell you, but since this is a oral history, and I hope that in maybe 10, 20 years in the future that parts that were made available to other graduate students, that they will give some heed to what I've said in looking back and trying to evaluate the role of your work in the development of...
Now, one point which deserves mention in this connection is Keynes knew appallingly little about 19th century economics and about 19th century history. He hated the 19th century for aesthetic reasons. I mean, while he was a great expert on Elizabethan history, he just disliked the 19th century so much that beyond Marshall and just a little John Stuart Mill and Ricardo, he knew nothing of the literature and very little about the history of the period.
A shame, a shame. I can't resist the remark that I've read, I think, all of Keynes's work, and the one that I regard as superbly good was the Tract on Monetary Reform. Where he does not make the errors he made later on, as mentioned. But
that reminds me of another thing. My first, it sounds almost ludicrous today, that shouldn't have been generally known, but while I was working in America in 23 and 24, my first essay on monetary theory, which I never published because Keynes' book came out, Tract on Monetary Reform, that I had taken great pains to demonstrate what I thought a new argument, that you couldn't at the same time have a stable price level and stable exchange rates, which was a completely new idea, but Keynes puts it that way, and so there's no point in publishing my article.
Well, that's the way it goes about that. In the price of production, on page 29 of the second edition, I ran across a sentence I don't remember you having made at that time, but you made a prediction about the future, which was turned out to be wrong, unfortunately. You said something to the effect, I don't have the exact quotation, that in the future, the theorists will abandon the concept of a general price level and concentrate on relative price effects of a change in the quantity of money.
It was a wish.
It was a wish, and I think it's beginning to now come about. The recent work on monetary economics is emphasizing now more the relative price effect, but up to the very recent time, it's all been on the relative price effect.
So the future was just a little more
may be correct, which leads me to a question I wanted to ask you, which is, again, a side issue. And well, something I'd like to contemplate, but I'm unable to get any place, is predicting what's going to be like 100 years from now. Have you ever tried that, and are you totally frustrated by it?
No, I'm much encouraged by the development of amongst the younger economists now.
By frustration, I meant not by dislike, but just inability to I feel helpless in trying to predict.
Well, after all, I now see that these things are having effects 40 years later than I hoped they would. I mean, the general phrase, which I'm using so often that you probably have heard it, is that I am pessimistic in the short run, optimistic in the long run. If the politicians don't destroy the world in the next 20 years, I think there's good hope for it. But the chances are not very great.
That's a shame. Well, but do you have any predictions, any beliefs about, not about economic theory, but about the state of the world, about the state of society, very...
I think the great danger is that the so-called fight against inflation will lead to more and more controls and ultimate complete destruction of the market.
I'm convinced of that, rightly or wrongly, hopefully or unhopefully.
Well, see, I hope that on Monday there will be a letter from me in the Wall Street Journal, which just suggests that the hopes they would put in every issue in headline letters, the simple truth, inflation is made by government and its agents. Nobody else can do anything about it.
For the benefit of government agents. But I shouldn't put this in the record. I just gave a talk at the Southern Economic Association meetings in Washington Thursday, and I stated that I criticized, let me make a self-serving remark, I criticized Carter, not in name, but for complaining about human rights abroad while destroying them at home by denying us property rights here, and said the way to do it is to have inflation, put on controls, and it's the politician's best friend.